Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour, bringing you the Great Schism. That's in the Vatican Centuries, Chapter 23. On a more musical note, the Pillar of the Cloud, better known as Lead, Kindly Light. And finally, does sacred art make the invisible visible? Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. I'd like to begin today by picking up again on our weekly appointment with the Vatican Centuries, a 38-part series written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. In the last episode, we reached the 14th century, hearing how two women put pressure on Pope Gregory XI to return to Rome, how the Vatican became a papal residence, and how the Great Schism began. Today we'll be following up on that Great Schism, hearing how the Council of Constance put an end to it. We also hear of jubilees and pilgrims, how the Romans sacked the Vatican, and how Catherine of Siena, a luminous figure, appears on the scene. Stay tuned.
Chapter 23, The Great Schism.
As the 14th century drew to a close, the disintegration of the medieval world continued on its inexorable course.
But the Renaissance wind was already blowing. As the enthusiasm for classical studies increased, the town of Florence emerged as the cradle of the new culture.
There could be found Donatello, father of modern sculpture, his friend Brunelleschi, who inaugurated the classic movement in architecture and designed the dome of the cathedral, and Lorenzo Ghiberti, working on the bronze doors of the baptistry, called later by Michelangelo the Gates of Paradise.
The Netherlands School of Music dominated the musical life of Europe, while from Flanders came the news that two brothers named Van Eyck had discovered a new process of painting using linseed oil.
With the birth of Henry the Navigator, the first oceanographer, a whole new era of naval exploration opened up. But it was also a time which saw the invention of gunpowder, and at the turn of the century, the passing of an act which made it legal to burn heretics.
The last decades of the old century and the first of the new, however, were marked by the gravest constitutional crisis to be experienced by the medieval church, the Great Schism of the West.
After the long absence of the popes in Avignon, the Romans had welcomed, in 1377, the return of Gregory XI. But he died not long after, and under pressure from the local populace, the conclave elected the Italian Urban VI.
He came into immediate conflict with the College of Cardinals. In recent decades, the power of the cardinals had increased considerably, and when Urban tried to use the plenitude of papal power, he met with opposition.
The French group, which was the largest, retired to Anagni, south of Rome, from where they issued a declaration that Urban's election had been illegal because it had taken place under pressure.
Urban declared himself willing to submit the validity of his election to the judgment of a council. But the rebel cardinals refused, said that Urban was a usurper and should be excommunicated. This was equivalent to a declaration of schism. The mutinous cardinals elected a rival pope, and soon the whole of Christian Europe was divided into two camps.
The schism lasted close on 40 years, during which time popes and anti-popes were elected, the former residing in Rome, the latter in Avignon. But after the death of the first anti-pope, Clement VII, the universities began to examine the canonical situation of the contending popes and studied how to end the schism.
Meanwhile, in Rome, life went on. Another jubilee came and went in 1400, when the number of pilgrims was counted as 120,000. On this occasion, a dramatic procession of 30,000 flagellants crying peace and mercy crossed the city. The people called them the Battuti Bianchi, as they wore white cloaks and cowls with a red cross on their heads. Singing hymns and beating themselves, they excited the people to a state of fanaticism, provoking all kinds of excesses.
Rome was in a constant state of uproar. Innocent VII, who was weak and old, was unable to control the city. Once, when Innocent was receiving a delegation of citizens, they began to insult him and accused him of doing nothing to end the schism. Present at the meeting was a nephew of the Pope's, who had been growing more and more irritated at the treatment his uncle received. This time, he acted. He waited for the delegation to come out, waylaid them as they left the Vatican, and promptly had 11 of the members killed and the bodies thrown out onto the streets.
The people went wild. They sounded the alarm, set fire to the cardinal's palaces, sacked the churches, beat up anyone who offered resistance. That same night, the Pope and his nephew, escorted by horsemen, left the city secretly. When the Romans discovered it, they stormed the Vatican, broke up everything they could lay their hands on, stealing even the relics of the saints. Many important documents in the archives were destroyed, while all over the city, the papal coat of arms was obliterated.
At first, the Colonna princes had attempted to lead the popular movement, but now it was clear the people wanted no leaders. The princes called in the King of Naples to help. He was a foreigner, and the Romans were even less willing to accept him as master than the Pope. They barricaded the streets and fought desperately, while sending a message to Innocent at Viterbo to come and take command of the city.
Public opinion had veered in the Pope's favour, and it was realised that he had not been a party to his nephew's crime. The King of Naples was defeated, and the keys of the city presented to the Pope.
Since the very beginning of the schism, the idea of calling a council to resolve the situation had been under consideration. But it was only when this was proposed by Paris University, called the third power of Europe, after the papacy and the empire, that the suggestion was taken seriously.
In 1409, a first council was called at Pisa by the cardinals of the two obediences. The rival popes were called on to attend and then abdicate. As neither appeared, they were both deposed and a third pope elected. But the other two popes refused to resign, so the schism was triple.
Finally, at the Council of Constance, convened in 1414, through the influence of Sigismund, the Holy Roman Emperor, the question was resolved and the schism healed. Gregory XII, the Roman Pope, resigned. Benedict XIII, the Avignon Pope, refused, but was abandoned by all but a few followers. And the third, John XXIII, fled from the council and was deposed.
In 1417, Otto Colonna, a Roman cardinal deacon, was elected Pope and took the name of Martin V. His pontificate marked the end of the schism and the beginning of the restoration of the ecclesiastical and temporal power of the papacy.
You were listening there to episode 23 of The Vatican Centuries, a programme written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. Next week we'll be hearing about changes and renewal, how the papal government reorganised, how nuncios were introduced and the Secretariat of State established. And finally, we'll hear all about conclave intrigues recorded by Pope Pius II. And now, on a more musical note, I'd like to join someone who works as an official at the Secretariat of State today, who also happens to be a music historian. He's Monsignor Philip Whitmore. Let's listen as he highlights music written by John Henry Newman, a story which begins 12 years before Newman became a Catholic.
I did not know before that nature could be so beautiful. It was like the Garden of Eden. That was how John Henry Newman described his visit to Sicily in 1833, 12 years before he became a Catholic. This visit was in many ways a turning point in his life. While he was there, he took ill with a fever and came close to death. It was after his recovery, on the boat returning from Sicily to Marseille, that he wrote The Pillar of the Cloud, better known by its opening words, "Lead, kindly light." This lovely poem is a great comfort to anyone who's been through a period of darkness, as Newman had during his illness. It speaks of faith that the light of Christ will always point the way forward, even though the night is dark and I am far from home. At the end of verse 1, Newman speaks from the heart, reminding us of his great struggle to recognize the path along which God was leading him. I do not ask to see the distant scene, one step enough for me. Lead, Kindly Light can be sung to several different tunes. My favourite is the one we've been listening to. It's called Lux Benigna, meaning kindly light. Newman himself was very fond of this tune, and it was written by one of the most prolific hymn composers of all time, J.B. Dykes. During the 1850s, Dykes was a minor canon at Durham Cathedral. When he heard of the plan to publish Hymns Ancient and Modern, the first large-scale collection of hymns in the English language, he rather timidly sent a few of his own compositions to the editor. They were well received, and he was asked for more. In the end, 60 of his tunes were included. Here's one that's still popular today. Those in peril on the sea. And here's another. In honour of the Blessed Trinity. A more recent setting of Lead Kindly Light is to a tune called Alberta by Sir William Harris, one of the leading figures in Anglican church music in the first half of the 20th century. I don't suppose too many of you will have heard it. Is better remembered for his choral music, and his greatest work is the glorious Fair is the Heaven, to a poem by Edmund Spenser. To give you an idea of his style, I'd like to play you a passage where the music tells of angels and archangels attending on God's own person without rest or end. Angels waiting on us in Newman's poem as well. In the closing lines, the kindly light which has led us on all through the night brings us safely into their presence. and with the dawn those angel faces smile, which I have loved long since, and lost a while.
And heartfelt thanks there, as always, to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who's currently working at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. Finally, on an artistic note, I'd like to join Monsignor Timothy Verdon, a professor of sacred art at the Theological Faculty of Central Italy, based in Florence. How would you define sacred art? Is it making the invisible visible?
Certainly, any kind of art that deals with the transcendent seeks to make the invisible visible, to help us see what human eye has not seen, it were music, to hear what human ear has not heard, but that which the Spirit, as St. Paul says, puts into our sensitivity. Sacred art is almost a technical term. Usually means works of painting, mosaic, glasswork, goldsmith work, sculpture, made specifically for the sacred places of the liturgy. And so, for example, a mosaic set into the apse of a church in Ravenna is by definition sacred art because it was intended to be seen in direct relationship with the celebration of the Eucharist. So too, obviously, altar pieces, so too, obviously, chalices, patterns of the objects actually used during Mass. There's a broader category that is often confused with sacred art, and understandably so. And it is simply religious art, art that deals with religious subject matter. And that would include, for example, many of Caravaggio's paintings that were made for private patrons for the individual delectation of the connoisseur, but where not only is the subject formally religious, but it's clear to the tutored or even untutored eye that the artist's intention was to read the formally religious subject in the light of the Christian tradition. So sacred art, specifically focused on the liturgy, religious art dealing with, in our case, Judeo-Christian religious subject matter.
You mentioned two periods so far, the Renaissance and Caravaggio, which is a completely different period. You also mentioned the fact that the church for a long time was patron of art and artists.
Yes.
Now, there's a benchmark, I think, in the history of art in the Catholic Church, which is 1964 with Paul VI, when he called all the artists, or a great number of artists living at the time, in the Sistine Chapel to ask forgiveness because the church had forgotten them, in other words, had not patronized new artwork. But he also chastised the artists for having forgotten about the church and the beauty of creation, etc. Was that a starting point for something new? It wasn't, was it?
It was and it wasn't. Paul VI, even before becoming Pope, was intensely interested in sacred art, in religious art, and indeed, as early as 1936, when he was a young Monsignor in the Secretariat of State, wrote what for that time was an absolutely revolutionary article in the journal which still exists, known as Arte Cristiana, Christian art, in which, from the relative eminence of his position within the Vatican, and therefore speaking with a kind of official authoritativeness, even though his actual rank was still quite modest, Montini said that the Church had to open its heart to contemporary art. And in saying that, he was implicitly criticizing the extreme conservatism of official Catholic taste in the 19th and early 20th century, a conservatism that imprisoned the generous patronage of the Vatican and of most Catholic prelates within the really very constricted space of a kind of nostalgic looking backwards. The Middle Ages to the Renaissance, a kind of neo-everything that refused the really very dramatic innovations in the same decades from the mid-19th century through the mid-20th century being realized elsewhere in art, and chose to present the church only in terms of the glories of the past, but of the past. And so when later in 1964, as Pope in the Sistine Chapel, but then again in a still more magniloquent way at the conclusion of the Second Vatican Council, in the splendid address to different categories of people, when he spoke to the artists there too, he made the point that the church in the past has always lived in a kind of fruitful alliance with creative people, and that in the visual arts, painters, sculptors, architects have created the buildings in which we worship, have decorated them, have made the invisible visible, have, as it were, plucked from the sphere of theology and theological discourse concrete expressions of what people believe in. And he implored artists not to deprive the church of their talents, but to put their inspiration at the service of the people of God, because he said, we need that. He also asked pardon of the artists for the neglect that five generations, if not more, his predecessors had been guilty of, and he sought to stimulate a new wave of Christian creativity. In retrospect, looking back at 1964, I won't have to say that there was an amazing immediate response, but as with the seed sown in shallow ground in the gospel, much of that initial enthusiasm proved not to have a lot of substance. Very often the artists were touched by what the Pope had said, but didn't really take the time, make the effort to enter into the meaning of the scriptural texts and events in the history of salvation that they were depicting. And after a few years, it kind of dwindled. Today, I think the problem is still very much alive. Some of the things that Benedict XVI has said, and I think of his comments in the introduction to the compendium for the Catechism of the Catholic Church, make it clear that he, like Montini, certainly like John Paul II in the beautiful letter to the artists, wants to reinvigorate this fruitful alliance with the artists.
Example of how you can preach with images. Is that possible? Is it along the lines of what the old lectionaries with the illuminated texts once had?
Of course, in many churches in Italy and in Europe, but even in churches in more recent Catholic situations, think of the New World, I think of South America, I think of mission countries in Africa, there are normally images. Catholic Christianity, especially liturgical spirituality, normally furnishes a visual focus for the believer. If the preacher, commenting the words of Scripture, talks in mere words, people will try to listen, but their attention wanders. If the preacher finds a way to relate what he is saying to the images that are there in the church, people's attention is riveted. A simple example, the crucifix above the altar is an invitation to remind people that the bread and wine offered by the community and accepted by God become the very body and blood of Christ crucified. The Eucharist is the unbloody but real presence of the fullness of his moral and physical gift to us on the cross. And one could cite many other examples.
Why do you think images are so powerful in communicating the mystery of the word? Do you think they play on our emotions? Do they break away from the restraint of words? Words can sometimes leave us passively hemmed in, no?
Yes.
By reason.
Yes. In English, we have popular expression, which is very accurate and for which there are equivalents in most languages, that a picture is worth a thousand words. And that is because the words individually can describe only one small aspect of something. As a man or woman listens, he or she has to put them together to come to the final image. The image presents it all at once. An example. In the Vatican treasury, there is a superb object given by a Byzantine emperor to a pope in the 6th century. It's called the Crux Vaticana. It is a large gold cross, positively bristling with gems and ancient cameos. It says more in the first instant you see it than one could say in a shelf full of books, because it immediately obliges the viewer to recognize the paradox of our faith, that that which was humiliating and a punishment and a source of death, the cross, in the mystery of Christ's Easter resurrection becomes glorious. I mean, to see a golden cross in the 6th century when the object was made, a cross studded with gems, would be like today seeing an electric chair in platinum studded with diamonds. You were looking at what was still clearly recognizable as an object of punishment for criminals, but which had been transformed into gold and gems, and your imagination was simply overwhelmed by the wonder of an impossible paradox that in Christ becomes true. Death which becomes life, humiliation which becomes glory. It's exactly the same thing. The cross for them was not a tame religious object yet. It was still recognizable as that instrument on which criminals were crucified. To interpret it in gold with gems was to say, he who was without sin made himself into sin for us, and the Father has raised him to glory.
But excuse me, most people don't have the doctrinal tools to understand that.
You don't really need a lot of doctrinal tools. Everyone knows that Christ died on the cross. To see the cross interpreted in expensive and rare materials invites you to make that shift. Invites you to ask yourself, well, why is this instrument of obrobrium here interpreted in a glorious way? To be sure, the preacher or the teacher, the catechist, can be of enormous help in helping people focus their attention, understand what they see and why there's something wrong with it, and helping them see what the meaning is.
And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow, so do join us then. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio, Laudetur Jesus Christus.